Hi, everybody. I'm Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful for the 7 or 8 minutes that Steve has left us to do this. It is an honor and a privilege to be here. First of all, I'll give you my statistics. My name is Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada, sober since July 17th of 1996. My home group is the Common Solution Group. We meet on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays in Las Vegas. And if you're ever in Vegas, we'd love to have you come and hang out with us. My sponsor is Charlie H., and he knows he's my sponsor, which is important, right? Because sometimes we have sponsors that... You sponsor Sheldon? Well, I... Oh. The other problem is with me is that nobody would ever say which Sheldon, right? If you name Bill or Bob, right? It's like, yeah, I sponsor Bill, you know, but I got one of those names, unfortunately, that it's hard to get lost in the crowd. So this first session, we titled "Not More of That God Stuff." Because we wanted to spend some time this afternoon talking about the first three steps, talking about our journey into Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to find a way to surrender. And what I heard, this is an old cliche, but I love it. How do you find a way to come all the way in and then to sit all the way down and then to stay in that chair? How do you find a way to do that? So I'm going to spend a couple minutes talking to you about my first step experience. I had my first drink when I was 9 years old, and I loved it. At 9 years old, something in my brain said, "Oh, you've had an alcohol deficiency, and for the sake of your health and well-being, you need to consume alcohol from now until the day you die." And I got in a little bit of trouble. I'm a Jewish kid, and at 13, my bar mitzvah, you're supposed to enter manhood, all right? And I walked into the party after the religious ceremony, and my grandfather said, "You're a man now. You watch the bar." And he went to go eat. There was clear stuff, green stuff, orange stuff. I mean, there was stuff it was fun. At my bar mitzvah, I slapped my mom, which is not part of the ritual. I know most of you aren't Jewish, so just so you know, there is no mom slapping ritual in the Jewish religion. You're supposed to have a photograph taken in your religious garb, looking all pretty. And I passed out on the couch. My shirt was untucked. My tie was to one side, and my grandfather had placed an empty bottle by my head, and they took that photograph at 13 years old. And what they didn't know is they were going to have the opportunity to take that same photograph many, many times. They thought, "Oh, this is unique." Click. It just was Tuesday. Click. And, when I was 16, I graduated high school, not because I'm smart. That's when you graduate in England. And I signed on welfare, and I got my own welfare apartment and my own welfare check, and I'm 16 years old, and I'm drinking like a fish. And my dad, who had moved to Southern California, I grew up in the north of England, he'd moved to California, came to visit and saw me living that way, and he said, "I'm going to take you to California, and we're going to fix you." And I don't know much about being fixed. But pretty girls and palm trees, right? All I'd seen is California on TV. I'm like, "I'll go. I hope Americans drink." Well, I don't know if they found out you do. It was safe. So anyway, I get to California, and the party's on. And I had a blast. Not all of my drinking career was horrible. Sometimes in meetings, when people share about their drinking career, you're like, "My God, why the hell would you have done it twice? It sounds horrendous." I had an amazing time. I found this small band called the Grateful Dead, and they've been following me ever since. I planned a vacation in New York next weekend, and those sons of bitches are playing at City. Everywhere I go, they show up, right? So I found these guys and everything that goes along with that, and I had an amazing time. I'm a fairground pitchman by trade. I sold Ginsu knives and oven cleaning products at state and county fairs. But wait, there's more. I ended up on QVC. I was a spokesperson. I'm printing money at 22 years old, having a great time. But something happened at 25. I turned 25. I had drunk myself out of that job. I knew it was because they didn't like Jews, by the way. Right? But they said it was because they didn't want an alcoholic crack addict as their national spokesperson. It's their world. I lose that job, and then I lose another job and another job, and I'm 25 years old, and it is clear to everyone, including me, that I shouldn't drink. And it's clear to me that if I would just quit drinking, my life would, you know, I'd go back on TV, I'd be a superstar. So I try not to drink. I go to detox. I go to a 7-day spin dry, and I come out of that pretty excited because I know that you guys are going to teach me how to stop or moderate, not sure which, but one or the other, and my life is going to make sense again. And I come out of there and I go to a halfway house. And I tell you, honestly, I didn't want to drink. I had messed around with quitting before, but I didn't want to drink. Something happens to me that is weird when I stop drinking. Something happens to me that is hard to explain. On the outside, my life gets better. I get a job. I pay my rent. To the outside world, it looks like quitting drinking was a good idea. But inside, I get this lonely, squirmy, empty, uptight, vacant, angry. And I tell you, I just don't feel good. And I feel insecure. I feel like the world is just like this dark and difficult place that I got to fight my way through and navigate my way through. And I feel like I'm so, I can't tell you, right? You can't go into a bar or into a halfway house meeting or some tough guy men's stag and they say, how you doing? And you go, oh, I'm a little insecure, a little squirmy, feeling afraid. I'm not sure if you guys like me. Then you go into your local men's stag and going, I'm just not sure if anybody likes me. Right? We don't, kid. Now sit down, right? So what I say is, fine, I'm fine. How are you fine? Fine. But inside, I'm just... So I get a plan together. And it's a good plan. I am not going to burn my life to the ground. I am not going to do it. There's no way. Why would I? It would be stupid. But I got an edge. And all I want to do is just knock off the edge. So I'm going to have one. Maybe two. Three at the most. No more than four. So I execute my plan, and it's a good plan. But something, and I don't get this, right? But somewhere between one and four, something happens where I think five is a good idea. Right? Well, we'll quit, you know, later, or to 7, 8, 10, and my life's burnt to the ground again, and I don't know why. It's okay. I'm gonna quit again. And I get stuck in this trap. And it's the weirdest trap. It's the trap where I can't stay sober. Because when I'm not drinking, the word that comes to mind right now is I feel alone. Which is a weird word for someone that doesn't know anybody he'd want to hang out with. Right? Right? That's how I feel like. I am alone. I look around the room and I judge all of you, and none of you are the solution to my loneliness, but I'm alone. And that's how I feel. I feel like an alien. I feel just empty, and I can't. You guys say the weirdest things. You can say, if I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous, check this out, this is funny. If I would come to AA, right, and do what you say I would do, I can stay sober one day at a time. And you say it like it's good news. Now that to me is a trip, right? Some guy's got 25 years sober, says he's 25 years sober. I think you poor bastard. Because from my perspective, what that means is for 25 years, this guy has felt like I feel right now, one day at a time. Right? That's what it sounds like to me. You can stay sober one day, one long, miserable, painful day at a time. And if you complain about it, what do they say? They kick back and they go, well, you don't have to stay sober one day at a time. You can stay sober 1 minute at a time. 60 miserable seconds. Tick, tick, tick. Let's face it, for me, maybe not for you, but for me, Alcoholics Anonymous is best described as a punishment for my alcoholism. And you have sentenced me to sit here miserably, one day at a time, for the rest of my life. And so I'm going to do the only thing I can do. I'm going to have one, maybe two, three at the most, no more than four. Because I can't not. And so I get drunk to get sober to get sober to get drunk to get drunk to get sober, and I can't stop, and I don't know what to do. And that is how I did my first step. Broken and stuck, not knowing a move. When a newcomer says, I'm so excited I did step one, I want to ask him, of what program? Because there ain't no good news, right? The only good news is what we're going to talk about next is step two, right? Because you can imagine if we had a one-step program, the suicide rate would be 99%.
John Evans, alcoholic. Hey, John. Great to be here and great to be sober. My statistics... sobriety date, July 5th, 1989. My driver's license says I live in Franklin, Tennessee, so I guess that's where I'm from. Sponsor and sponsor as many guys as my sponsor will allow me, plus a couple I don't tell them about. I'm really grateful to Steve asking me to do this. He called a couple weeks ago and said, I think it'd be good if you guys got involved in the roundup. Be new to town, we'll get you plugged in, and I don't talk with Steve much, we talk every now and again, and I was struggling getting plugged in. When you move somewhere with short-term, long-term sobriety, it's tough to get plugged in, and so I was really grateful for that, because where I got sober, I was the king, and so... It was, it took a long time to earn that, title in where I live. But so you know how disheartened I was to come here and find out that Steve was the king. Because he's not old enough where I can wait for him just to die off. So I'll shoot for Duke, I guess. But he didn't ask me to do this. He asked me to be a host, and then... something happened with Jeff, you say, hey, will you fill into this? And then I was, you have to say yes, but I really didn't want to say yes. I'm the guy that likes to be asked to speak, but I don't really want to speak. I just want to know that you like me enough to think I'm qualified, but these workshops are always, I don't mind telling my story anymore, right? You can tell it in your sleep, put people to sleep with it, but the workshops are always a little weird because you feel like, like Barclay said before the workshop, I'm going to get my notepad, right? Like there's going to be some golden nugget involved in this where, you can leave here and not go, that was what I've been missing for the last X amount of years. And I was going to tell you, but Sheldon already did, that, by example, that there are no golden nuggets during these workshops. To calm the nerves, my beautiful wife came, which she should be sitting up here. She said, let's pray together, and we said a prayer, and we turned this meeting over to God. And so if this meeting sucks, we know how God feels about my wife. Which is not going to happen, right? Because she is the most spiritual woman I know. She's been a spiritual lighthouse for me for 28 years, and I couldn't be more grateful. It's been tough keeping her sober this whole time. But enough of the shtick. I got asked to fill in. I love these titles because I passed over this second step, thinking, "Oh yeah, I believe in God. Let's go on to the next one" for a long time. But you were going to try to break this into 1, 2, and 3 and pass it back and forth. You know, I believe I was born with this disease. You know, I know some people, you know, somewhere drink themselves into alcoholism, I guess, and fall asleep at the boardroom table and wind up here. And that wasn't me. I was alcoholic from the beginning. I had the restless, irritable, and discontent before I ever found alcohol. I mean, nothing was right in my world. You know, I grew up in this is not why I'm an alcoholic, but I grew up in this crazy alcoholic home, you know, and just, you know, it was madness. And, but the restless, irritable, and discontent was everywhere. But when I added alcohol, it was a game changer. And my first intentional drink was at 11, but, you know, in thinking about it, I was exposed to alcohol and some pills before that, you know. I was so ADD, I could not sit through a 50-minute class as a kid, right? Like, I mean, when I say I couldn't, I'm not like saying, honey, I can't take the trash out right now. Like, I couldn't. Like, I'm exploding in my chair after about 25 minutes, and it was just awful. And so I would skip school all the time. I'd make up excuses not to go to school. I'm the youngest of four kids, you know, and by the time my mom's taking care of my father's alcoholism, and by the time I get to the young, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 year, she's done raising kids, you know, doing the best she can to keep the lights on. And, you know, I remember I found chloraseptic, which I've been told has a little bit of alcohol in it. And, you know, I'd say, Mom, I can't go to school today. And she'd say, well, you look fine. I'm like, no, I really can't. And she's like, well, I'll go get the thermometer. And she'd put the thermometer in my mouth. And as she left the room, I'd put it on the light next to me, and she'd come back in, and I'd stick it in my mouth, and she'd say, Jesus, you have a temperature of 120, we got to go to the ER, you know. You got to time that just right, you know, but not too hot where it burns your mouth, but, you know, hot enough where you get to stay home. And she'd lead me home and with the chloraseptic, and because I have a sore throat, and she'd come home, my mouth would all be red like a clown, you know, and I didn't really know, you know, what that was, but my first intentional drink was at 11. I was at my sister's, youngest of four. I'm at this fancy little wedding. You know, it's the late 80s. We're the typical alcoholic family in the neighborhood, you know. My mom's done her best to, like, put on the event, you know, for the Joneses, and little did they know, little Johnny was going to make his debut into alcoholism, and my uncle gave me a couple drinks and a couple drinks and a couple drinks, and that very first time of intentional drinking, I drank until I got completely out of my mind. I blacked out. I threw up. I urinated on myself and just did my best to ruin the event. I didn't. They're still married. So, but what I want to tell you about that event was that that's how I always drank. I didn't go through. I got sober young. I know I look like I'm 70. I'm not. I got sober at 17 years old. Just turned 50, and I didn't have this long period of, I'll just have four. It was always, let me get to oblivion as quick as I can and stay to oblivion. But what I remember most about that event was the next morning they had this little party, you know, little going away breakfast or brunch, I guess is what, you know, the well-to-dos call it. And they were all kind of laughing about it. My brother certainly was. My dad was really happy that he wasn't the one in trouble this night as, you know, the family alcoholic. And my old battle axe Aunt Martha, she said, I bet he'll never do that again, because I was just so violently ill. And I remember, I can still remember that, where we were all sitting, and I can't wait to do that again. I've finally found what I've been missing, you know. And I was fortunate that my old man owned a bunch of bars, and our house was always stocked with alcohol, untraceable, uncountable, made me very popular. You know, we had a very typical 2,500 square foot home and a basement, and the basement was just littered with half cases of alcohol, because his MO was he'd start a business, it would go bankrupt, he'd bring a bunch of alcohol home and start, you know, that whole cycle. And so, you know, I could just go downstairs and drink whatever I want whenever I wanted, you know. And it got me here at 17 years old. I'll briefly tell you that I found the fun stuff that goes with it, and it just multiplied my disease. It was like adding water to a chia pet. I just, you know. You guys remember the chia pet on the old people's drugstore? I mean, it was just, but it was faster than that, you know. And when I found the right combination, I made a decision this is how I'll spend the rest of my life. I do not care. You know, there was just things, and it wasn't because of the circumstances, although they were crazy. I did not have the tools that you guys had. Well, not you guys. The other, you know, the normal people that I was there with, you know what I mean? You guys didn't have the tools either. And I just, you know, Bill talks about the alcoholic thinks his life is the only normal one. And I so resonate with that because I didn't understand why everybody else went to school. You don't have to go to school. Because where I lived in this well-to-do county, Montgomery County, right outside of Washington, D.C., like, you go to the next grade no matter what happens. They don't do failures, you know. And I learned to become a pretty good negotiator with that, right? Like, I played the game of chicken. Like, let's see the least amount we can do and wind up in the next grade. And lo and behold, they just kept doing it. You know, there was this – they had this school program for young drunks and junkies called something for work or early work – you know, it's like you come to school half a day and then you go to – McDonald's, you flip burgers half a day, and they give you credit for that because they know you can't come a whole, you know. But it was available only to seniors, and I had convinced them that in my freshman year I have to go to this program or I'm out, you know. And they didn't want to drop out, you know. It's where I learned to negotiate, and it came to a point where like I couldn't even come to those three or four classes. My 11th grade year in high school, the principal called me in. I still remember it, you know. He said, "John, you have already exceeded the maximum unexcused absences in the state of Maryland. But we're going to make an exception. You know, we're all the exceptions, right? And if you can come these next 11 days, we'll pass you on. Can you do that? You know, because I'm tired of going to summer school. I'm tired of going to night school. That sucks, you know. And I said, yeah, I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. You know, and I made it for a day. I couldn't make 11 days. And the next day, a guy that looks like Sheldon sees me in the hall and says, "Hey, I got a bottle, I got a bag." And what happens, and Sheldon described it beautifully, is I think I've changed my mind. I said, "You know what, night school wasn't that bad last year." You know, because, you know, alcohol and drugs weren't my problem. They were the only solution I ever had. That was feeling a restless, irritable, and discontent that was killing me. It was the only solution. And I traded, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, you don't have much to trade, but what I had to trade, I traded, right? You know, I wrote off my entire future for that, you know. You know, this whole idea of powerlessness is what, you know, we're leading into in this conversation of this God business, but I never doubted it. I never struggled with it, and I just didn't care. That was my battle cry. I do not care. You know, they would call me into a person of authority would call me into their office. I don't know when you finished, but just whatever. You know, a position of authority would call me, you know, as a principal, a judge, or a cop, or somebody, and they'd say, they'd sit me down. You know, I think this should be in the 20 questions. And they'd say, you know, we've seen your file or folder or whatever, you know, and we don't understand what's going on with you, you know. And they say, you know, and they mean it, like, well, you know, what is wrong with you, John? What is wrong with you? And I'd put my butt back in the chair and put my elbows on my knees, and I'd look down at the ground, and I'd play this game of silent chicken for as long as I could. And if they won and I answered, I gave them the best three-word answer I had. It's the most honest thing I ever said. I don't know. And it was the truth. I don't know what's wrong with me. And the fact that you are asking me what's wrong with me discounts you from ever being able to help me. All right? Because if you're so damn smart, please tell me. I need to know. Because I knew at four there was something wrong with me. And I held on to that for as long. If I hadn't found alcohol in the way that I did, I'd have killed myself by 15. I really would have. You know, and so as we transform this conversation into the second step, you know, this powerless was never an issue for me. I knew I was an alcoholic from the beginning. I knew there was no such thing as three or four, you know. I love that question on page, whatever, is the beginning of We Agnostics 44, right? If when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely. And the first time I read that, I was like, well, I don't know if that qualifies for that, because I never really tried to quit. Like, I mean, who quits? You know, I mean, that's a bad idea. Quitting is a bad idea. But in that second half of that question, you know, or if you have little control over the amount you take. It's like, oh. And then my sponsor explained to me it was an or question. And when I told him that first half didn't really apply to me, he said, really? You never quit? I said, no, I didn't quit. He said, well, you know, I heard your story. You got arrested three times by the same cop on the same street, you know, within 3 weeks period of time with 16 felonies. What did you say in the back of the police car? God, I'll get, God, get me out of this. I'll never do it again. See, that sounds a little bit like quitting, when you were detoxing in the hospital for a couple of days and you say, I'll never do this again. Like, but I'd never really taken that honest, like, I'm never going to quit. It was just a temporary circumstantial thing. And so what I'm getting at is I'm so grateful that when I got here that no one, it was not a missionary force that came and got me, right? They were glad that I was there. They weren't really upset if I left. And that was the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? This language of the heart, right? Wasn't you need to, you shoulda, you coulda, you woulda, right? It was like, this is our deal, and if this resonates with you, we'd love to show you the way. And I couldn't be more grateful, because when I got here at 17 years old, I was not a high-value draft pick, Like, the old-timers were not knocking themselves over to help me, I mean, they were willing by any means, don't get me wrong, but I was that kid that ruined the meetings, come in late, leave early, drink all the coffee, smoke all the cigarettes, make a mess, and then leave. And every now and again, you'd be dumb enough to call me during a meeting, and I'd take it hostage, and the whole group would go, don't call on John. I'm going to turn it back over to Sheldon.
So I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous, hopeful that you guys can help me with my drinking problem. And the first conversation I have with anybody about quitting drinking is so disappointing. Because at first it's like, oh, you drank like me. Oh, you did dope like me. Oh, you feel like me. Oh, my people. And then I say, well, what are we going to do when we hang out together? And you say, we're going to look for God. Like, is there anything else that we could do together? I have a real problem. This is how I feel, right? I feel like I have a real problem. This is real, right? I have been in trouble with the law. I have lost every good job I have. I have can't pay my rent, right? My parents are incredibly angry at me. I haven't had a girlfriend in, ever, right? Some people are dangerously, in the book here it says we're dangerously or disgusting. The dangerous guys get the girls. I was the disgusting guy. We get nothing, right? We get nothing. So but I got all these real problems. These problems are real. And you come at me with your Santa Claus fake fairy tale nonsense solution of we're going to go look for God. Now, I know I'm in the Bible Belt and I got to be careful, right? But he's forgiven me for all my heresies, so we're safe, right? But I just can't understand. I mean, right? I don't believe in God. Okay, so look, here's the deal. I told you that I grew up in a Jewish home. This is true. But it was an atheist Jewish home. Right? Now, what I mean by that is we did all the rituals, right? And we went to temple on the high holidays, right? But we didn't believe in God. I mean, you don't have to believe in God to go to temple or church, do you? You just don't. You can just be doing the dance. You do the hokey pokey. And we did, that's what we did. We did the Jewish hokey pokey, except for the bacon part. We still ate the bacon. Maybe that's why I'm an alcoholic. That might be it. Maybe it's because I'm a bacon-eating Jew. You never know. This is a new thing. I had to come to the Bible Belt for God to tell me that if I just didn't eat the bacon, I wouldn't have to deal with you people. But you know what? You're worth it. Because screw it. I love bacon. So who cares? You're worth it. But anyway, let me just, that might have been the nugget. Let me just reel it back in just a little bit. I got off track. I'm sorry, Todd. So anyway, right? So we're these atheist Jews. Like, my mom would say things like, she'd say, God is the opiate of the masses. It's for fools and children. Now, get dressed. We're going to temple. In the sect of Judaism that I grew up in, I actually grew up in a religious, Judaism's like Christianity, right? There's a million different types. And I grew up in the Hasidic temple in a very religious sect of Judaism. Like, not my, all the whole deal. Not my parents, but my grandparents, right? And so my parents were, like, starting to come away from it, and then we just tore it all down. But anyway, but on Shabbos, on Saturdays, you can't drive. And so you'd have to walk to temple. Well, the Jews had moved from the bad neighborhoods where they settled in the 30s out in the, after the Second World War in the 50s, out to the, it was 5 miles away from the, and you could see them all. Every Saturday morning, dressed in their freaking black coats and black hats, walking five miles in the snow, uphill both ways. That's what I call 5 mile Jews. We were two block Jews. We would take the bus to two blocks away, make ourselves look tired, make sure you couldn't smell the bacon, and then walk the rest of the way, right? So you know. So we weren't really serious about our Judaism, is what I'm trying to say. And I had some resentments, right? I went to a Jewish day school, and it was just like your nun experience if you're Catholic, right? I did that whole deal, and I had resentments against the Jewish religion, and I can't do the Jewish religion, I can't. And when you guys talk about God, it means one of two things, right? It means going back to being Jewish, which I can't do, right? Not possible. Or it means becoming a Christian, which I have to tell you, that's the one thing that you can get away with bacon, but you can't get away. You just, there's no way. I mean, if I learned one thing, it's that I learned two things. One is that Judaism is just silly, and the second thing is Christianity is sillier. Right? I just want to point out, some of you have been laughing at the whole Jewish thing the whole time, and I made the one Christian joke, and you're looking at me like I'm a heathen. You have inventory to write, you have work to do, and I hope your sponsorship line is strong. You can survive this. You can get through it. Anything's possible in Tennessee in 2022, for God's sake. But I can't do my God, and I can't do your God, and God's the only answer, and I can't do God, and I'm not doing God, and I don't believe in God, and there is no God, and I can't do God. I'm not doing step two, can't do step two, can't do step three. Can't do, I'm not going to do. Hope you got something else. Said that to my sponsor. Hope you got something else, because I can't do God. And I'm, like, scared because, all joking aside, I'm stuck in this step one deal. Can't drink, can't not drink. Burning my life to the ground. Want to kill myself. Like, dark, lonely, frightened moments. And you guys are giving me an answer that is not attainable. It's not attainable. And I don't care what you've got to surrender to the idea it ain't attainable. I can't do it. Right? You want me to lie to you about it? This is life and death. Is that what you want? You want me to lie? Okay, I believe in God. Are you happy now? I'm still going to die. And I'm telling my sponsor all this, and he's just like, Jesus Christ. Jews are crazy. But anyway, right? So, but he says the craziest thing to me. He says, you don't have to believe in God to do step two or step three. I said, what are you talking about? He says, I'm going to prove it to you out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to show you in the book where it says, you do not have to believe in God to do step two. But first of all, I want you to go out to the home group. Go talk to the guys, your friends, people you respect and you like, and ask them why they're sober. That's dumb. All right? Because I know what they're going to say. It's almost like it's handed out on the back of a business card, right? Like, if I asked you, I know you're going to say, well, I'm sober today by the grace of a loving God that I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank God for the 12 steps of AA and AA for leading me to God. I know what you're going to say, right? So I'm like, go and I ask them, and they say, by the way, if you're new, I want you to know that I'm sober today by the grace of a loving God that I found. I would like to thank God for leading me to AA and AA, for leading me to God. I just want to let you know that that's not who I was then, right? I go to him and I say to him, they all said God. And he said, well, Sheldon, let me ask you a question. If you could find God in step two, or even in step three, why the hell would you do step four? Seriously, it sucks. Mm. I mean, really. It's horrible. You've never been to a meeting and heard somebody go, Invisalign full step, baby! Right? Everybody hates it, and no one knows how to do it. Right? No one knows how to do it. There's a million workbooks on how to do it. A million of them. There are people in this room, right? I'm one of them. I'm a big book reading, step working son of a gun. And there are other big book working, step doing, and we disagree on how to do it. We can't agree. Even the big book thumpers can't agree on how to do a false step, for God's sakes. It's very confusing. Step five is embarrassing. Six and seven, nobody understand. Eight and nine, incredibly expensive. 10 and 11. This is real stuff. 10 and 11, so confusing. Half of you think you're doing step 10 when you're really doing step 11. Now, this is important. Some of you are going, what's he talking about? The ones that are going, that's right, that's your spiritual arrogance. You got work to do because you're just happy. You know shit no one else knows. That's right. They think they're doing 11. It's with, oh, no, they don't know, right? You got inventory to write and sponsors to talk to. Too much Diet Coke. Who got me this Diet Coke? For God's sakes. For God's sakes. Anyway. So I go back to my sponsor and he says, I'm going to show you in the big book exactly where it says you don't have to believe in God to do step two. And he takes me to page 47. And there's a lot of beautiful writing about step two. Some of the writing on step two is some of the most beautiful writing that Bill has done. It's very amazing, open, spiritual. You can see things and find things, and you know that it just will allow a simple guy like me to connect with God. But there is the place where you do step two, right? There's a place where you do step two, and here's the place where you do. It says you need to ask the new man but one simple question: do I now believe? Do you now believe? Or are you even willing to believe in a power greater than yourself? Answer that question in step two, or not, right? But here's what the question says. Do you now believe, or are you willing to believe? See, what I thought it said was, do you now believe in God? If so, right, great. If not, then go direct to the jail, do not pass go, and do not collect $200, right, is what I thought it said. But it doesn't. Here's what it says. And this is what he pointed out to me. He says, Sheldon, you don't have to believe in God. Do you believe in God or? Or means you can say, no, I don't believe in God. Do you believe or are you willing to believe? What does that mean that you're willing to believe? Are you willing to believe that maybe, just maybe, there might be a God? I mean, I know it's unlikely, right? Put you on a lie detector desk. There is no God. Gun to the head, no God. I dig it. You don't believe in God. I don't believe in God. No God, no God. There's no God. We agree. There's no God. There's no God. I agree. No God. No God. God, no God. No God. But are you willing to believe that maybe? Maybe it's possible, perhaps. There might be. It's unlikely. Very unlikely, highly unlikely, but is it possible that maybe, just maybe, there might be a God? Maybe? Possible. Not definitely, but maybe, perhaps. Well, I could say that even though I don't believe in God, it is possible that maybe, perhaps, there might be something, maybe. Maybe. Are you willing to believe? I'm willing to believe. I am willing to believe that, as unlikely as it is, I'm willing to believe that there might be a God, yes. I'm willing to believe that. Then the book says, as soon as a man says that he does believe, which I didn't, or is even, and Bill's so great, he puts the word even. He doesn't say that a man is willing to believe, he goes, even willing. Like, that patheticness of willingness. That much. He's even willing to believe. I doff my cloth to you, sire, for you are. In fact, you may not be king, but you are princely. Even willing to believe. At that moment, the book says, we emphatically ensure him he's on his way. Like, yeah, baby, you're done. Step two in the bag. So if you're new or you're not so new and you're wondering about what step two is, we just did it.
I wasn't trying to cut you off by taking your soda. I just...
Just trying to protect the innocent.
Yeah.
Well, every now and again, I get to tag along with my sponsor and do a weekend or something, and we negotiate whether I get 5 or 6 or 7 minutes out of the hour. And when he's had 2 cups of coffee, it's none at all. I just sit here and I love talking about this step. I'm going to talk a lot on Sunday about one of our, what's the last title, Mistakes in Recovery, or
The Struggle is Real, Baby.
The Struggle is Real, Baby. And I've got a lot of those, but I'll briefly tell you that I just ruined my life at 18, 19 years of sobriety. I went back through the steps thinking that the golden nugget I had missed, and when I say ruin my life in sobriety, I'm not talking about what Jimmy did at 5 years. I mean, that was a mess, but mine was like a super mess, like IRS, police, foreclosure, ambulances, hospitals, like, you know, I went all out. You know, I'm a full measures guy. And but I got hooked up with a guy that believed in the book, and I said, man, you know, I need to do the 4-step with you, because that was my missing nugget, you know. And we went back through the whole deal, you know, and what had transformed my life really was the second step in hindsight. You know, this idea of developing a relationship with the power greater than myself was really just kind of on the side to me for many years in here. Like the first time I went through this test with my sponsor, he said, okay, you know, do you believe in power? You know, and yeah, sure, okay, let's go for it. He said, you know, even though God hates me, but yeah, I believe in him, but God hates me, you know, because I'd done some cruddy things that we all have done when we got here. And we went on with the rest of the steps, you know, and some really wasn't even anything close to the big book format. I got sober in an AA club, and there were not many big books around. You know, we had a couple of guys that were self-appointed gurus, and we just did what they told us to do, you know, which was go to more meetings, you know, and every now and again would, you know, do some step work when our butts were on fire. But going back through and because the whole title of the chapter, We Agnostics, blew me away. Like, when I went back through it with a new set of eyes and a new willingness, you know, was just incredible. I did not know it at the time, and I would have passed a lie detector test that wasn't the case, but I totally ignored that chapter for years in here. I was like, I'm not an agnostic. I believe in God. That's, you know, might as well be to the wives, right? Like, you know, none of us are really paying attention to that in the meeting, right? I know you're not. I mean, the wives might be, but, like, us guys are, you know, what time's the game on? And because that's how ADD I am. But that's how I had treated We Agnostics, you know. And so, like, reading it with this fresh set of eyes just blew me away. You know, my old Charles sponsor, you know, I was like, I don't understand all this talk. You know, Bill says in there 7 times that we got to get rid of these old ideas, these prejudices. And I was like, Charles, I'm not prejudiced. You're black, I'm white. I'm not prejudiced. I don't get it. You know, he's like, oh, my God. You know, like, that's not what they're talking about, dummy. Right? Like, that's just, you know, I had to get rid of these old ideas. You know, my experience, and Bill says all throughout the book, that these 12 steps are divinely designed by God to remove what's blocking us from him. That's it at the end of the day. And my experience proves that to be true. And what's blocking me in the first step is obvious, right? Mm-hmm. And in the second step, what's blocking me from having experience is these old ideas about God. And if you know, when Sheldon was yucking it up, which I love to death, I've learned to look around for the guy that's not smiling. I remember I got dragged to my first conference at a young person's conference, and Cliff Roach was talking, who's funny. And there was 2,000 people in the room, and everyone was laughing, and I was not laughing. I had 90 days of sobriety, and I was dying. I mean, I was drier than a forest fire. And I had a couple bucks in my pocket, enough to buy a tape, not a CD, or a pack of cigarettes. That was my more dilemma that night. But I was dying to know why they were all laughing. You know, so look for the person next to you that's not laughing this weekend. I don't know why I went down that tangent, but as we went back through this, you know, these old ideas is 1,000% what's blocking me. Like, how can I really turn my will and my life over to the care of God if I think he's keeping score? How can I turn my will and my life over to the care of God if he's not big enough to solve my problems? You know, because as I told you, I got sober at 17, right? Like, this idea of a spiritual awakening, you better get that. You know, this spiritual awakening, like, I've had a spiritual awakening. It happens at outside of the Grateful Dead concerts in the parking lot. You know, I understood this idea that I need God, I guess, but like, I was not all in on this deal, you know. But I kind of believed he hated me, so let's go forward, you know. And the third step in that was like this. All right, God, I'll turn my alcohol and my drugs over to you, but I'll handle the money and the women. It seemed like a good allocation of responsibilities. Because if I really turn it all over, and I don't pretend to really know how to do that, but if I really turn it all over, am I going to get what I want? Because I just know getting what I want will make me happy. And I even had that confused, right? What I really found out what I wanted in Alcoholics Anonymous was peace. I just want to be able to answer the phone. I just want to be able to, when I get introduced to somebody, I don't look at my shoes. I mean, open the mail. I mean, you know, those are things that I couldn't do for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I knew where I was going. You know, if you weren't laughing, took me a little while. If you weren't laughing when Sheldon was yucking up, we're not trying to sell you any brand of God in here. Right. Someone once said in a meeting, you know, whether you're all the great religions, you know, whether you're Jewish or Christian or Buddhist or Muslim or whatever you are, Mother Earthish, whatever you are, they all have one thing in common. They send their drunks to Alcoholics Anonymous. Right. We absolutely do not care what you believe. We are, and I know there's your nugget. You gave me one, I gave you one.
Right.
Where are you?
I like that.
Right. We just do not care what you believe. You know, I know there's like a super smart, you know, millennial in here that's saying, you know, no, you guys are selling me the baby Jesus deal. You said the Lord Prayer after the meeting. I know it. Like, no. Like, we don't care. But you have to believe in something. Because in the first step, you said you were powerless. Right? You know, one of my earlier sponsors told me, John, the only reason that someone does what you do, right, lives in a way that is against your best interests is either you're dumb as a box of rocks or you're powerless. Which is it? I know these things are not good for me. I know this is going to have dire consequences tomorrow. But I just don't care. Right? Because this idea of being stuck with me at this moment is just intolerable. You know, so I'll trade in the future. You know, the title, We Agnostics, I believe we're all agnostics when we get here. Right? So I went from this transformation of, well, it doesn't apply to me because I believe in God, to, well, that just applies to the less fortunate that don't believe in God, to this, that I'm agnostic. When I got here, and for a long time, I was an agnostic. And I submit to you that you were too. Right? And I'm going to tell you why, because the definition of agnostic that I'm using is, a Gnostic is someone with experiential, effective, working relationship, working knowledge of. Like, that's the old-timey definition, right? So if you're a Gnostic, you understand it, and you have a working relationship, and it works, right? So if I had an effective working relationship with God, halfway before I got here, I would have tapped into the little baby Jesus and gone the other direction, right? It would not have gotten as bad as it got. But I did not have that effective working relationship. So by definition, I'm agnostic when I got here. You know, and they would say, John, you just need to have a little bit of faith, just a mustard seed of faith. And that's, oh my God, you know, whatever. Because I had this working knowledge of if I could just make my life look the way that I want it to look, I'll be okay when I got here. Spiritual awakening, if it happens, great, you know, whatever, okay, I'll pray, you know. And what Sheldon says is true. You don't have to believe in these things for them to work. Just say the prayers, you know, do the work. Against my willingness, it'll work. So they say, you know, have a mustard seed of faith, and someone once, I actually stole this from somebody, but, you know, typically we think a mustard seed is just the tiniest of flecks, you can barely see it. But in biblical times, that's not what it meant. The definition of a mustard seed was two things. One, it spread like wildfire. Now that's the kind of faith I need to have. And it had medicinal healing purposes. So when someone says you need to have just a mustard seed of faith, that's the type that I'm looking for today. You know, and as I went through the step work with my sponsor trying to identify these old ideas, man, it was a long list. I had 18 years of sobriety, you know. God's keeping score. And I still have that circumstance today. I still fall back on those old ideas today. That's why we all got to continue to work with each other, have a sponsor. Because, you know, I forget what I believe on a regular basis, you know. You know, my transmission breaks down and I think God's getting me back for screwing the IRS out of $3,000 last year or whatever it is, you know. You know, I didn't tell my wife about some part I bought for my boat, you know, and it doesn't work right. I know God's punishing me for that, you know. Mike Allison's not here, is he? He's out fishing. Son of a gun. But that was really it, that I'm not good enough for God, you know. I'm still in the negative. I can't, you know, those lady scales of justice, I just can't do it, you know. I'll never be back to zero. And when I'd been, you know, about 10 years of sobriety, I went on this search to figure it all out. And I'm really glad I did. And I love the faith that I found to some degree, and I hate the faith that I found to some degree. I'm not going to have that conversation tonight. There's not enough time. But in hindsight, right, that's how we learn stuff. Like, I was trying to figure it all out. Like, because I want to know the boxes I got to check. Right? Like, I understand you guys have showed me the recipe for sobriety, right? Meetings, prayer, sponsor, go to the detox, you know, do step work, read the book. Amen, right? But like, you know, I want more than that, right? You know, I want the big house, and I want to, and I'm sure later, you know, sooner or later, I'm sure I'm going to die. I don't think I'm going to, but if I do, you know, like, I don't want to burn in hell. So I got to figure this out, you know, and I went on this quest to find the system. And what I found was that I didn't need a system, right? I mean, Bill tells us clearly, right? Like, we're never going to fully figure this out. You know, we'll never fully comprehend that, which is God. I mean, what a arrogant thing to do in hindsight, right? Like, that we all do, right? But the flip side of that is that even though that is an arrogant quest to try to figure God out, this journey of developing a relationship is the most important thing that we do, right? I mean, is there anything more important that I do today than try to establish that contact with God? No, without question, the answer is no. And the even wilder question is, why don't I act like that, right? You know, we're talking about the 11-step, sometime misunderstood as the 10-step inventory. You know, a lot of people text these back and forth with their different groups of friends, and I love when my guys send these, you know, when I read them. You know, the one question about, you know, what we're thinking ourselves most of the time. Oh, no. No. I put on, you know, like, of course I was thinking of myself most of the day. I mean, imagine if you had two stopwatches going, and one clicked when you were thinking about yourself, you know, and your needs and your job and your wife, but you. And the other started and stopped when you were trying to seek God and develop that relationship. I mean, 5% on a good day? I mean, think about that. You're awake for 18 hours. 5% of that's an hour. How many of us really do that? Now, I know we go to a meeting for an hour, but what are you thinking about during that meeting? You know? Either what you're going to say next, or why hasn't he commented on what I just said? You know? What did you say? Go to 2:30?
Yeah, we're done.
We're done. Really grateful for this opportunity. Looking forward to spending more time with you guys tomorrow. And we're going to turn this back over to Steve.